I'm here with Ryan Cook. He is the co-founder of Preston's Paradise, which is a community, what did you say
resiliency.
It was? A community resiliency project in the Belmont neighborhood of Philadelphia. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Thanks for having me over.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So let's get started just talking about how'd you get started with this whole project? What got you interested? How'd you end up here in West Philly? All that stuff.
Sure. I do a lot of things, so it's hard to say what this is, I guess. But, I mean, Preston's Paradise, what we see it as is really, I guess, the highest order of what being a good neighbor looks like. And to us, that means really recognizing the unique skills that you bring to a community and realizing the partnerships that you can build that help those skills come to fruition to help the greatest number of people achieve their own goals. And so Preston's Paradise has really been built around food, because my wife and I were gardeners. We have a lot of gardening experience, networking, and love. And we found a home here in this part of the city where there's a lot of recognition of that type of work, a lot of familiarity around that type of living and lifestyle that we found a natural partnership for. And so we've built it now into a community organization, a small neighborhood project that builds orchards, community gardens, backyard garden plots, in all kinds of different places and spaces in our neighborhood to create what we call Edible Belmont. It's a living food forest, food community, where you can walk 4 blocks in any direction and pluck fruit off a tree, and it's a pretty amazing thing to live around.
Yeah, especially in a city where there's definitely a dearth of greenness.
Yeah, one of the reasons, we moved to this neighborhood 8 years ago, and one of the things that really drew us here was that there's big backyards, there is a lot of green space. Part of that's because there is a lot of vacancy and a lot of divestment from this neighborhood, and so it doesn't always come from a positive point of view, but you know, we see it as a resource. And I think a lot of times people come to these neighborhoods and only see the lack of community or the lack of resources. And I think it's just happened to be where we were in our lives. We said, actually, this place is great, but then able to find a way to really share that positivity, to share again, like how these resources can benefit people, to not only people that live here, but people from the outside that maybe then go away with a different perspective of the place.
Mm-hmm. So is that, how did you end up here in this particular neighborhood? Were you in a different part of Philadelphia and ended up here because you liked it, or?
Yeah, so this is my 15th anniversary in Philadelphia. I've pretty much only lived in West Philly. And I used to teach at U City High School, which is one of the neighborhood high schools in this neighborhood. And so I knew a lot of kids that lived around here. And so I used to come up here quite often, either to drive kids home or, you know, just kind of, you know, we were running programs or whatever. And so I had some familiarity with the neighborhood. And when we were looking to buy a house, this is one of the neighborhoods we could afford to live in. And so we looked around what we could afford. We really responded, I think, to the physical infrastructure of this neighborhood. It's very close to a lot of other things. It's geographically well situated. And also because I knew kids from here and had some experience with here, it felt comfortable in a way, or accessible. And we didn't feel like we were, I think, moving somewhere we didn't belong.
Mm-hmm. And what are the geographical boundaries, the loose ones, of Belmont area?
Sure. Well, I think most people know Mantua is the neighboring neighborhood. And it's, I think most people know that it has sort of a notorious reputation. And so Mantua goes to 40th Street. And then to the west of that, from 40th to 44th, is Belmont, primarily between Lancaster Avenue and the railroad tracks. So
okay.
Preston Street is basically 40 and a half street.
Okay. So Belmont is kind of in that, like, West Park kind of area, right? That, like, far west, a little bit to the north.
Sure. So if people know, Baltimore Avenue kind of goes southwest from Center City, and Lancaster Avenue goes northwest from Center City. And so, you know, we're kind of near the zoo. You know, it's a weird little pocket. There's not a lot of stuff happening around here, but it's very, you know, has a long history. Preston Street is named after Annie Preston, which was the first woman graduate of the Pennsylvania Medical College.
Oh, really?
The first woman doctor.
Oh, cool.
I think in the whole country, if not, and definitely in Philadelphia. And actually, the building right across the street from our house was the first women's hospital in Philadelphia.
Interesting.
And now it's a home for senior citizens. But, you know, this neighborhood has a really interesting health history. And mm-hmm. And I think we're proud to carry on that tradition.
I used to live at 48th and Locust. Mm-hmm. I lived like in that neighborhood for the first 3 years I was here.
40th or 48th?
48th. Uh-huh. And never came out this way.
Yeah.
I had no idea that this was, and I felt like I was really in West Philly because I was just past the University City kind of line. But I had no idea that this was, that there was even a whole neighborhood up here.
Yeah, West Philly is huge.
Yeah, it really is. And I think that it kind of gets, particularly in public health in Philadelphia, West Philly kind of becomes this huge area on the map that's always red because everything is terrible.
Yeah.
And it really kind of, it whitewashes the diversity and the actual, the people who live here and are, you know, doing what they got to do, living their lives.
Yeah, one of the great strengths of Philadelphia and one of its, you know, real challenges is really the block by block nature of a lot of things that happen here. I mean, we got really lucky. I mean, as much as I had some familiarity with the neighborhood, I really didn't know what we were getting into. It was, you know, we saw the house, it was completely wrecked, and we said, yeah, this looks great. You know, we had some other people that moved in a block away and had a terrible experience. Their block was, you know, just full of lots of problems, societal problems, just all kinds of things you can imagine. Our block has been wonderful to us, and that's not us, that's just luck, I think, in some ways of, you know, maybe it, you know, maybe we had some inkling and we were looking around, but you know, really, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a huge neighbor, it's a huge space, West Philly, but and really there's so many little pockets that have so many different histories and stories and experiences.
So you worked as a teacher at U City High School, right?
Right.
And that's one of the schools that closed last year.
Just got Bob so Drexel.
What was it like teaching there? Because it closed, supposedly, because it was such a difficult school to run.
So I wasn't a district teacher. I worked for the Urban Nutrition Initiative, which is a nonprofit actually run out of Penn that does nutrition education with public high school or public school kids. And so I had a lot of different jobs with them. And my last one before I left the organization was working with high school youth. At U City High School, we have a large garden there, and so the kids would come and get paid after school to work in the garden and run some entrepreneurship projects. We also ran a carpentry class, and they had a really nice shop there, and other things like that. And so, you know, my experience is definitely very different than being a full-time in-class teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of more flexibility and a lot more autonomy. And the ability to work after school and not such a formal education setting. So
right.
I definitely can't speak to what I think teachers experience in that school, but you know, the school environment working in it is very challenging. And I think that school, you know, people a lot of times compare the prison industrial complex and the educational industrial complex. And then you look at that building, you're like, this building looks like a prison. You know, it has the central courtyard and, you know, the high brick walls with really tiny slit windows. And so just being in that physical space, you definitely, it didn't feel like a happy place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we definitely worked with kids that came from very difficult situations. And I'd say it's definitely the hardest job I've ever had. But I think, and a lot of that, I think, is you're trying to do positive things in a really negative place.
And yet those kids fought to keep their school open.
They did. Yeah, they did. And I mean, I think, again, even if it's something terrible, it's what they have, right?
Right.
In a neighborhood where people are always trying to take stuff away, I mean, you're going to fight for anything you have. And you know, Drexel, I know, is building a new school. It doesn't sound like they're building a high school, but hopefully that the school they build will still be accessible to the public, will still be a neighborhood school, and hopefully
mm-hmm.
will improve the educational experience. But, you know, there is something lost to having a neighborhood high school. Yeah, we'll see what becomes of that.
So have you noticed any changes in the neighborhood since the school closed?
In this neighborhood, not so much. We're quite a ways away from the actual school. I mean,
okay.
I think definitely Lancaster Avenue, which is our main commercial corridor, is seeing a lot of change, and that property being sold and now being redeveloped into retail is going to tremendously change what the corridor looks like, which is going to have huge ripple effects. I think our neighborhood now is being speculated more by investors and property developers because of all the changes that Drexel is creating. And so that type of impact, I think, is being seen a lot. The impact of the families. You know, there aren't a lot of high school age kids around here anymore. I think we have a lot of older senior residents in this neighborhood and a lot of really young kids. And so that in-between age, there just aren't a ton right now. You know, neighborhoods go through these different cycles of... Mm-hmm. of boom and bust of child age kids. So, yeah, I haven't seen that so much, yet.
So, tell me a little bit about how you started, Preston's Paradise and just the beginnings of that. What was your very first step with it?
The very first step, when we bought this house, and even before, I mean, this place had been abandoned for 10 years or so. And like, so it had no roof, you know, just, everything was just the wettest, you know, like just wetter than actually when it was raining. This building was just like, you know, you were like, the whole thing was a giant puddle. It was crazy. And I saw there was colonies of mold in the basement that, you know, would like had some type of sentience that would blink at you. Like, things I'd never seen before or since. And so even before we fixed some of those issues, we were planting. I mean, again, that's just who my wife and I are. I'd been done this project around gardens at uni for, you know, 6 years before that. And so I definitely, you know, it was what I recognized as making place my own. And so we planted some fruit trees and started gardening. And almost immediately, especially the seniors across the street who have this, you can't see it on the radio, but it's an 8-story apartment building with 90 senior apartments, and they're out there looking out the windows every day and, you know, being nosy as people can be and saying, what are you doing? And, you know, within the first week made some really fast friends there of people that used to garden, either grew up down in the rural South or used to garden in this neighborhood and can't anymore because of physical liabilities or because they live in an apartment building and don't have space. But, you know, they were like, oh, when that's ready, you know, give me a call. And so, you know, I didn't think we were prepared for that, of how our very private act of, our personal act of gardening was gonna, I think, attract so much public attention. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, we said, oh, well, this is clearly something that resonates in this neighborhood and something that we can do. And us being us and saying, well, we're moving to a new neighborhood. We don't know a lot of people. We need to, you know, really figure out what being a good neighbor means to us. We said, well, gardening is something we can help spread. So we put a garden at the senior home for them to use and donate produce. We started bringing, you know, vegetables over across the street and giving them out. And then started looking around and saying, where else can we start putting gardens and fruit trees? And ended up with this network of 10 different sites with churches and schools and a home for autistic adults and the senior center and people's backyards, with the original goal of just trying to grow as much produce as we could to give it away. Mm-hmm. But a couple things happened. One, like when we started giving produce away, the seniors particularly would say, no, you know, like, I want to pay for this. Why won't you let me buy this? And we kept saying, okay, well, give us whatever you want, you know, fine, you know, we'll take a donation. They're like, no, like, tell me how much it costs, you know? And so I think there was a learning curve for us of realizing that it's, as a neighbor, you have to, or especially in a neighborhood project or community project, you have to find roles for everyone. And if they can't actually physically garden, then even by buying something, that's a way to participate. And I think the biggest role of a community organizer is finding a way that everyone can participate. And so it started out as you know, allowing them to buy the food. Then it became, oh, well, allowing people to host their own gardens and learn how to tend for them and grow them themselves. And it became allowing people to host meals and workshops and teach skills. And so it became, I think, larger than we had ever planned or intended, this, you know, robust community organization that was doing workshops and community meals and planting, you know, 10 garden sites and doing all this harvesting. We started a mobile market where we'd actually push the vegetables around on a little cart down to the avenue and places and sell them. And then at a certain point we had to step back and say, like, whoa, you know, this is a lot to maintain.
Yeah. So then what happened after you expanded so much and realized that you were had
created
this
monster?
Two
things, and I think, you know, I also, every time I'm interviewed, I, you know, ask people to force me to talk about our failures, and I think, because that's, you know, just as important part of the story and something you don't hear a lot of. And, you know, I don't think we ever really, in all of our, it's really easy to start a new garden, right? It's a lot harder to actually, like, build the systems that maintain gardens and build those democratic, you know, organizations that can sustain themselves. And I think we put so much energy into expanding and planting more plants, we didn't actually spend the time to, again, engage our neighbors in how to sustain it. And so we realized that we were putting in too much of our own individual time, and we were in danger of burning out, and then everything would fall apart. And that was our own failure and our own, I think, arrogance and hubris to say, like, oh, we can just keep planting more and more and more, without making sure that we found those people that had, you know, even though that was our skill, we didn't spend the time figuring out who has the skill to actually build a real sustainable neighborhood organization that engages people, keeps the project bounded and measure, and, you know. And so when we realized that, we said, okay, well, what we can do now is we can scale back. We can try to divest ourselves of some of this responsibility. So if something happens to us, we have to leave, the whole thing doesn't fall apart, but someone else can come and pick it up, the pieces. And so we transitioned a lot of our gardens. Well, we gave a lot away, which was the original goal. As we said, if we build this garden in your backyard, we'll take care of it, but then at a certain point, it's yours. And so mm-hmm. All of our backyard gardens, we gave to the homeowners, and they're caring for them now, which is great, was the original goal. Some of our gardens that were in vegetables, we transitioned to orchards. Orchards, we found, are not only easier to maintain because the trees can grow even if you don't do anything to them, right? You also can just mulch them. And it's also, I think, more approachable for someone that doesn't have a lot of familiarity with fresh food. They know what a strawberry is, even mm-hmm. if they don't necessarily know what to do with a collard green. So,
yeah,
you know, we have this huge, our most successful project up the street at this home for autistic adults. It's all four sides of the building, it's a new construction building, is all edible landscaping. And we did that with the Philadelphia Orchard Project. But we have an entire half of a city block in strawberries. And every wow. single time I go outside my door, there's someone over there picking the strawberries. The kids walk this on Preston Street to get to school now because the strawberry patch is on their way to and from school. Like, seniors are out there in the morning picking veggies for their, you know, partner's breakfast. You know, So every single time I step outside my door, and like, people that would never have come into a community garden, never would have come to a workshop that we were doing, the strawberry patch allows them to engage in food in a way that is meaningful to them and allows them to incorporate in things they're already doing instead mm-hmm. of us asking them to change how they're doing stuff. So fruit and orchards just, to me, have a very different impact in how people engage with edible living things than gardens do. And so
that's, you know, so interesting that yeah. fruit is so much yeah. more appealing than...
Well, it's sweet, right? And you don't have to cook
yeah.
it, you know?
Yeah, you don't have to cook it. Everyone knows what to do with a strawberry.
Everyone
just
knows what to do with a
it.
Strawberry, right? Exactly. So, you know, we started transitioning some to orchards. And so now we only have three... and community gardens. So some of the ones that we were just doing production for the markets now are community gardens. Other people have plots. And so we've really scaled back our own involvement. I don't think... We still haven't... Then we had kids, we had twins, so then everything fell apart, which is good, and it worked out great that, you know, all of our sites are still going, they're being maintained, they're luscious, they're producing food without us having to be there day in and day out, but because of the twins and us being incredibly busy with that, we still haven't had the chance to really figure out what the next incarnation of it looks like. Are we still mm-hmm. going to grow back again? Is this the end result of our project, where we just have tons of fruit trees in this neighborhood, and that's good enough?
Yeah.
Or are we trying to go back and doing more programming and trying again to really kind of build a community movement around it? And I don't know the answer to that yet.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's what happens. Time will tell.
Yeah, time will tell. And it is just really nice not to feel that pressure, I think.
Mm-hmm. So this is kind of almost a silly question, but what happens in the winter?
What happens in the winter? I mean, in some ways, the orchards look a lot better than a vegetable garden does in the winter, so that's another benefit,
true.
You know, but, yeah, I mean, I think we've been blessed in Philly in some ways that our winters have been kind of shorter. I mean, we're harvesting vegetables until December, and then,
really?
You know, stuff is getting back in the ground. You know, again, we have asparagus and rhubarb and things in March, and so it doesn't feel like that long, you know.
Yeah.
We have a little greenhouse. We do some, like, potted, you know, the seniors all want house plants. We mm-hmm. still do some work with that. Our, you know, so, you know, there's stuff going on, but, you know, everyone hunkers down in the winter. It's not such a big
Yeah, thing. I guess that's true.
Yeah.
How are you guys funded?
Right now, we're not funded at all.
Okay.
So we got some grants. We got some small neighborhood foundation grants when we first started, and that money took us a long, long way. And, you know, it was always an all-volunteer project, so we never mm-hmm. needed a lot of money. It was just stuff to buy starts. We would pay someone in the neighborhood every once in a while to cut the grass or whatever. But so, yeah, that was part of the organizing principle. I didn't want to create another nonprofit in Philadelphia. I've worked for too many, and there's way too many than we need. And so I knew we didn't want to do that. But it's a hard line to manage, because without a nonprofit, you can't raise enough money to really pay people to do
right.
good work. And with a nonprofit, then you have to maintain all these systems of infrastructure to keep things going and keep your, you know, books in order. And so it's hard to maintain a really small neighborhood organization and have high goals, I think, without putting in a lot of your own personal energy, which we're willing to do to a certain point. But, you know, you have to have lots of people do that. You have to have a really good transition plan, or what you see a lot of is things come and die out and go away, and you have to start all over again.
Yeah, so. You get the charismatic leader
yeah.
who puts their whole life into something, and then it's not a sustainable organization afterward.
Right. And what we like about the fruit trees is, and even the gardens, the soil is good, the spaces are there. Like, if we disappear, it's here, and someone else can very easily pick it up and start it over again. So,
like you said, fruit
yeah.
trees will just keep growing even if you don't do anything
yeah.
to them. So, have you partnered with other organizations in the area that are doing this kind of either this kind or other types of community work?
Sure. So I mentioned the Philadelphia Orchard Project. I was on the board for a while, but they're a really fantastic organization that all they do is plant orchards with community groups, any type of community group. And so, you know, they definitely helped with us getting the plant material and designs and things when I had never planted a permaculture orchard before. So they've been a really big help. The Philadelphia Horticultural Society runs a program called City Harvest, which actually gives out free vegetable starts to community organizations that agree to donate a certain amount of food, particularly to food cupboards. So we definitely get veggie starts from them that we plant, but also we give away to our community gardeners and other people. So it takes off some of the financial burden for people to start new gardens. And then again, all of our garden sites are with a partner agency in the neighborhood. So whether it's the senior home, the autistic adults home, the church or the school. So those neighborhood partners are really, you know, important to what
mm-hmm.
we do. And then the mobile project, the mobile markets, has expanded now citywide. And actually, it got too much for us as Preston's Paradise to manage. It was too successful in a way. So we actually, you know, reached out to Greensgrove, who I've worked with for a long time, and they've taken it over now. And it goes to senior centers all over the city and brings produce from our gardens, but also produce from Lancaster County and other farms in Philadelphia, and takes it to places that don't have markets. And so that's been, you know, our great export.
Mm-hmm. And they take the PCA fruit and vegetable vouchers,
yep.
right?
Yeah, FMMP vouchers. Yeah, we take food stamps and cash and credit cards, and so that's been great.
That's awesome. So you're not directly involved with the mobile carts anymore?
Well, so I'm
or you
still
are.
Technically in charge of it, although, you know, again, I like to start things and find the right people to run them, and so I have a staff now that pretty much runs the day-to-day of that project for Greensgrow, and
okay.
they still come to our neighborhood. And I still help with making sure their community partnerships are working. But this, our wonderful staff, Lauren and Kiana, they run that. And we're able to hire people from the neighborhood to work it. And so that's always good. And so that's.
I must have been thinking, I was thinking about this interview on my way over here.
Yeah.
And I drove past a mobile grocery store associated with one of the senior citizens nonprofits in Philly. And so it was this truck, and the doors were all open in the back, and it was this grocery store, I guess, but it was entirely processed foods. And I was, first of all, I had never heard of a mobile grocery store like that. So I don't know if it's from Philly or from another.
Is
I didn't
it in Philly
see.
Though?
Yeah, it was
Where
at
was it?
22nd and Market. Yeah, exactly. That was my response, was I didn't know this existed.
Yeah, I never heard of it.
So that got me thinking. I wonder if these...
And people were going inside the truck?
Nobody was going in. It was small. It was almost like one of those small refrigerated trucks.
Yeah.
I don't think a person could even stand up in it. It was more of a reach-in.
Huh.
But it was all...
And it said PCA on it.
No. I don't want to say it was PCA. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it definitely had some organization, but I was going too fast and I didn't see it. But that got me thinking that the produce trucks must fill a niche that really needed to be filled. That I know when I lived in West Philly, and there's one actually by where I live now in South Philly, there are these big produce trucks where you can go and get a bag of oranges for like $2. So I was wondering what makes what you started different from those types of trucks.
Sure. I mean, definitely those produce trucks have been around for decades in Philadelphia and is a huge, often under recognized resource when people do food access studies and everything else. And it's this really unique thing that Philadelphia has, partly because we're one of the largest fruit and vegetable ports in the country. And so if you go down the food distribution center by the airport, there's a tremendous amount of fresh food that comes into Philadelphia that you can get for very, very cheap if you're willing to make the hike and buy a caseload quantity. So I think in some ways we're really well positioned to have food access work happen in Philly. Not to mention that we have Lancaster County and South Jersey and third and fourth most productive agricultural lands in the country right outside our doorstep. So, you know, there's a tremendous amount of fresh food in Philly. So these produce trucks, and we also had heard that a lot of these, there's people in vans that bring produce to senior centers. So, but what we kept hearing from the senior centers is that they were inconsistent. They were bringing only a couple different things, mostly fruits, maybe some collards, but mostly that they were inconsistent. And also when in doing this work for a long time now, you learn that food access is a barrier, but isn't really the biggest barrier. There's lots of studies that show you, even if you put a whole supermarket in a neighborhood, it doesn't change how people eat, because supermarkets also sell lots and mostly unhealthy food, and they have a produce section, right? And more you see this budget type grocery store model comes out, which is shrinks the produce section even more. They have these bottom dollar stores where it's now all inside a big walk-in.
I've been there. I think bottom dollar is great. I don't know if you have a lot of criticism of them, but I find their produce to actually be of equal or better quality than most of the produce I can get at a regular grocery store.
Sure.
So, and pretty good variety.
Yeah, everyone's trying to innovate. And I think, you know, but, you know, even that, and maybe if you have a good produce section, maybe people are buying a little bit more fruits and vegetables. People eat what they eat. And the fundamental problem with grocery stores is that they don't have people that can actually work on systemic dietary change. And so what lots of people have found is that what actually changes people's diets is personal connections, personal conversations, and reinforcement week after week after week after week. So what our trucks do is not only do they bring you food directly to senior centers, but we're putting knowledgeable staff on there. We always have at least two people, so someone can be doing transactions while the other person can be having conversations. They all come either from nutrition programs or either graduates of programs like Uni that trains kids in growing and cooking and working with food, but come from those neighborhoods and can talk to people about what it is that they're eating. We're also doing cooking demonstrations. We're also, you know, providing lots of materials. And so when we ask people what they like best about the mobile markets, it's the people. It's not the food. The food is nice. You know, it's great that it's convenient. You know what I mean? But like, they really like, and I think benefit most from having those conversations week in and week out about what it is they're trying new, what recipes do they just hear about, you know, and then, you know, what makes sense. And we have so many conversations with diabetics about, you know, agave syrup because it's a low glycemic index. You know, we have lots of conversations about people that have, they're on heart medications and can't have vitamin K, and so are having trouble eating their greens, you know, all those things that you can't get from the internet now, where you just get so much oversaturation of information that especially seniors have a hard time digesting it down into actual, like, actionable knowledge. And doctor's offices now, you don't have those relationships with your medical professionals that you used to get, you know, quality advice. And definitely the supermarkets, you can't pull anyone aside and actually ask them a question. And so it's that type of community relationships that actually sustain dietary change. We've had a lot of feedback and success, I think, in actually getting people to eat more fruits and vegetables because of that. And so that was our organizing principle around the mobile markets, was the access, but also this knowledge and reinforcement type of behavior. I love the produce trucks. I think they're great. And the other thing is those produce trucks and supermarkets, they're selling very low nutrient density foods. I mean, there's still foods that are harvested weeks before times. Even if they look good, they've still been off the farm and you lose half their nutrient value every 24 hours. And so even 3 days from the field to table, you know, you only have an eighth of the amount of nutrients that it was when it started. And so we're able actually to, through our relationship with GreensGrow, get food that day or the next day from farms in local areas, either organic stuff, which most of these truck supermarkets don't have, but also just fresh pick stuff. And so we're actually really selling nutrient density as well.
That's really interesting, and a piece of this that never gets mentioned.
Right, because people say, oh, the tomato looks good, but that doesn't, you know, and it's a really hard conversation to have, because there's lots of other things. You can talk about how sweet a peach is, which, you know, but to talk about, you can't see the nutrients in a food. And so it's a really hard thing to get across to people. I think they know what fresh is, but fresh just means that it still has water in it, I think, to a lot of people. Right. You know what I mean? You know, and so, yeah, so we still struggle with how to actually impart that information, but it's really important, and I think a big part of why we do the way we do. Even if we only know it, we know it's a better thing for people.
Right. So have you included like dairy or baked goods or anything like
that? Yeah, so the other thing is, you know, we looked at mobile markets around the country, and a lot of them were just these very quick, like, pop-in, pop-out sort of stops. And only focused on produce. And we said, well, you know, what people really go to the store for is bread and milk, and then right. they buy produce, and that's why they put the produce out front, so that you have the, because your body still has this innate prehistoric, you know, attraction to red round things, right? And so, like, that's why the produce is right in the door of the supermarket. You walk in, you're not going there for that, but when you see it, you're like, oh, I have to have that.
Right.
So, you know... We realize for the opposite. If we want people to come to our produce truck, we really need to have the bread and the milk that gets them there, and then they see the produce and they buy more produce. So, yeah, we have milk and eggs and cheese and tofu and all kinds of healthy nuts and granola and raisins and dried fruit and drinks. And again, one of the things that really people respond to is the idea that this is a healthy corner store from the ground up. I mean, the food trust tries to modify existing corner stores to be healthy corner stores by throwing in some fruits and vegetables, but you know, we said, you know, we're going to build one from the ground up. Everything on this truck we can stand behind and say is healthy. And again, it reduces that information processing that people have to have, where they can go to the truck. They don't have to wonder, well, am I getting this low sugar option or this low salt option? Am I getting this one that says light? But they just know whatever they choose, we can stand behind that decision. They can stand behind that decision. And it becomes a pleasurable shopping experience instead of an anguish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, again, we're really recognizing and people are really responding to.
That's really interesting. Just the idea of trying to reduce the stress that comes along with
food can be very stressful for people.
Yeah.
Even take aside like the monetary side of things, where people don't feel like they have enough money for food, which we also address. But like, that there's a tremendous amount of knowledge out there. I have a hard time going to a grocery store. I'm trying to buy a bag of chips and I'm just like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I don't know what to do anymore. So, you know, you compound that for especially people as they get older in life and or have kids and all these different like complexities that people happen, or they start to have health issues and they don't know what's best for them. I mean, it's a really, really hard thing.
And because they don't necessarily get that information from doctors or whoever it is that could be telling them, because the words on packages basically don't mean anything.
Yeah.
They're just all marketing.
Yep.
So how do you address the financial issue?
Well, again, by buying directly from farmers, we're actually able to meet or beat most grocery store prices. So, and by taking food stamps, you get the food bucks. If you use your food stamps, you're actually getting $2 extra for every $5 you spend.
You are part of that. Mm-hmm. Oh, yep. Okay. That's great.
Yep. So, you know, we can really help people stretch their food dollars. We also do a low income CSA. So people have SNAP, they can get a CSA box. That's only $6.50 a week and you get a whole box of produce.
$6.50 a week for CSA.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, it's subsidized. So, so there's lots of things we can do to help people.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So if somebody wanted to learn more about you or what you're doing or any of these projects, like where could they find you online?
I'm all over. But the Preston's Paradise website hasn't really been updated in years. But Greensgrow is greensgrow.org/mobile-markets, I think. But if you just go to the greensgrow.org main page, there's a mobile markets tab which has information about that. But Preston's Paradise these days, I mean, we're keeping it very low key. I mean, we stopped doing the workshops when we realized that A, most people coming to the workshops were out from outside the neighborhood, and B, everyone and their brother now was doing workshops around sustainability issues in Philadelphia. So there wasn't really that role for us anymore. And so, you know, that was our real sort of thing that we would be outside that people would maybe hear of us about. I don't feel a need really to hype ourselves, you know, outside of, you know, person two doors down. So, but you know, our website has some basic information about us and where we are, and there's some maps I think of where the orchards are, and definitely people are welcome to come and look at the orchards and sample the fruit. It's getting to be peak season. The cherries are ripe right now. The strawberries are definitely ripe.
Do you have Rainier cherries outside your door?
We have our house. We have a vacant lot next door, and we have 15 fruit trees on our property.
Wow, and it's not a big property.
And it's not a big property. And that doesn't even count all the berry bushes and low-growing shrubs and everything else. And so then, you know, up the street, well, across the street at the senior home, there's another 6 fruit trees and a whole community garden. Then at the end of the block at the autism home, there's probably another 15 fruit trees and a whole bunch of other stuff. And then a block and a half down at the school, there's another 20 fruit trees. A block and a half down the other direction, there's a whole another garden. Like, I mean, it's an incredible amount of edible stuff in this neighborhood now.
Wow.
And that's the stuff we've done. I mean, there's also old community gardens and people that have been gardening in their backyard long before we got here. And so, you know, again, we're just working with the strengths that are already here. And the strength-based analysis of community development, I think, is what we really are drawn to. And again, not doing it perfectly, but you're finding one little corner of it and trying to leave something useful behind.
Leave some trees behind.
Yeah, leave some trees behind.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.